Hello, everyone, and welcome to NWR Connectivity, episode 332. I'm your host, John Reardon, and I am joined, as I usually am, by Neil Ronahan.
Hey. I don't know. This is sparking weird.
Neil's deep in the world of Ionios.
I was just trying to think. I was like, oh, I don't have like a outside of the fact that they use spark instead of the word fuck. I can't think of a token Xenoblade 3-ism.
You could have just done like a really bad British accent.
Yeah.
And like talked about killing God
Rebellions
or something.
Rebellions are built on hope.
wrong one. But speaking of, I don't have anything. Alex is also here.
Hi guys, it's been a minute. How
Welcome
about that new
back.
Whooper?
Oh yeah.
I mean, yeah. I mean, we don't have it on the agenda, but like Scarlet and Violet, I'm in.
Well, yeah, but Nintendo, I know you're listening. Can I catch Pokemon on the overworld
without going
into battle?
Why didn't they show that?
Why won't
it's hilarious.
You tell me?
It's incredible. Like,
at this point, you're doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
Like, just tell me.
We are halfway through the marketing cycle. More than that? I forget when they first... Yeah, they announced it early. We are more than halfway through the marketing cycle of this game, and we still don't know, like, fundamental parts of it.
Right. And it's... the longer it takes, the more it concerns me that they weren't ready, and they didn't realize that was going to be a part of Arceus that really clicked.
Yeah.
And that it's definitely not that way in the game. And maybe... I mean, it's Pokemon, so like it takes them roughly 10 minutes to develop a game. So they may have already been working on changing
the
it.
The DLC for Scarlet and Violet is just going to be, you know, perfect.
It's
for
just
it.
The same game, but you can
but
catch
obvious.
Pokemon in the overworld.
But we do have ride Pokemon back.
Yeah, why does the red one run when it has wheels?
I imagine it unlocks the ability to use the wheels. I'm not sure.
But the blue one seems to always
care.
Use wheels. Why does the red one run? I hate it. I need
this
it to
stuff
stop.
Stuff is wild. I love it. Like there's a certain disaster thing about Pokemon that I just love, and that like every trailer is going to be like, oh, this is really cool, but what the hell is that?
Yeah, this is great. Why did you make these choices? I will say, I think it looks better than Arceus.
Yes.
While still
that's
like
doesn't take a lot.
No, it's simultaneously a huge improvement over Arceus while also still fascinatingly avoiding doing very simple, non-expensive things to like just anti-alias it, you sassy bitches.
It really does look like a better looking Sword and Shield. If I could use a comparison, it's kind of how I feel playing Xenoblade 3. That like Xenoblade 3 still kind of looks like visually like Xenoblade 2, but it looks like a better version of Xenoblade 2. Much like I feel like Scarlet and Violet from what we've seen, which we're not seeing it directly on a Switch system. It's just like, okay, it's the vibe of Sword and Shield, but improved.
What's crazy to me is that like Xenoblade 3 oftentimes runs at 540p and manages to look very clean on a TV, whereas Pokemon, based on what Arceus is running at, this is probably running at like 720 to 900p, but it's just raw ass naked pixels.
Yep.
And that's not pleasant. And if you would just anti-alias it, this would look gorgeous. Like it could still use some other things like texture resolution ain't great, but like I'll take it. It's an open world game. I get it. That's fine. But like FXAA is not an expensive thing to implement in your post-processing.
Maybe they expect you to play it on a CRT.
Maybe. Maybe I have an HDMI downscaler. I can make that happen.
I really do love like the I guess art design might be the like I like the look of Pokemon. The look of Pokemon has always been a thing that I've liked, whether it's been, you know, like the art that they've had separate, like I don't know if it's concept art or key art, whatever you want to call it. Like that's always looked great, and that implementation of it into sprite work, 3D models or whatever, like that's also usually great. It's then since they've, I mean, and I guess you could kind of, you know, pin it to once they move to home consoles, that like then you're like, oh, that like I love the look of the design of the oh no why does it look like that in this.
Even the individual assets generally look okay. It's just like the way
movement.
They're meshing them together into the world and presenting it on your screen just feels raw.
I remember Let's Go Pikachu, Let's Go Eevee looking pretty good.
They look fine. Honestly, I think Sword and Shield look okay.
Yeah.
Outside, I think the wild areas are a little rough, but like, it was kind of their first time doing something like that.
The trick to the wild areas is just don't play them online.
Yeah.
Like, don't do a huge part of the game. And
I do feel Arceus at least ran pretty well.
Yeah.
Like, I'll give it that. It was fairly smooth.
There's a reason why I gave that game. What did I give it, a 9?
I gave it a 9.
I think, yeah, it was an
Nintendo
8.5, right?
Thought I gave it an 8. I was greeted when I went to go buy Xenoblade 3 at GameStop. I walked out and got stopped by just looked at the Switch demo console that they had there as the incorrect score for my review came across the Pokemon Legends Arceus. I'm like, this thing's been getting play for months, and it just sucks because they're probably like, wow, Nintendo Report was kind of harsh on it, giving it an 8.
Really...
I'm like, no, bro, I gave it a 9.
Nintendo just doesn't. Nintendo is like that worst kind of editor that goes in and like tries to change your score.
Yeah, they're probably like, I don't know. I think the visuals would have affected it more if I scored it.
Like, the Nintendo read your review and was like, this reads like an 8. We're gonna just go ahead and modify that.
But yeah. I mean, that's the thing is, like, Arceus, like, I say visually, not the prettiest game I've ever seen, but also everything else about that game freaking rules. So
yeah, you know what I'm glad we haven't seen is the weird boss fights from Arceus, where it was like, let's have dodge rolls and try to do like Dark Souls boss fights in our Pokemon game for no apparent reason.
I think those didn't bother me as much because they were like so nothing.
I hate it. Like, they weren't hard, but I just hate it. They played so horribly and were so like anti to the rest of the experience. I'm just like, why is this happening? Please make it stop. But yeah, I haven't seen any of that in Scarlet and Violet so far, which is a good sign to me.
And I mean, there are things as far as like, even if it's not quite Arceus level, you know, collection and combat, you aren't doing battles in a void. It looks like battles are actually on the overworld,
yes,
which is kind of cool.
That's just good from just a smooth gameplay perspective,
yeah,
if nothing,
yeah,
else. Like, just don't
agreed,
hit me with a loading screen.
But I'm very curious to see, like, as with every news drop that we go through and they don't clarify what it is, it just like puts the pressure up to be like, okay, what's gonna happen when they like clarify that, like, actually it's just like Sword and Shield, or like, oh no, we completely redesigned it like Arceus.
Yeah. And I still, you know what, like, if it is like Sword and Shield in that one aspect, I'm still interested. I noticed that they said it's the first open world Pokemon game, which I know Arceus was kind of like
Arceus is open zone. No,
it's, yeah, it's segmented, but I would still say that's, I mean, I'd still say it's open world, but that's just me.
Like Xenoblade.
Yeah, because all roads lead to Xenoblade. I think it was in your questions. Yeah, like questions that people were asking about Xenoblade, where you were like, it's open world. And I remember seeing a couple comments that, like, I actually kind of see the logic when they're like, I mean, it's open world, but it's like not quite open world in the way that, like, I mean, Skyrim is open world, whereas Xenoblade is like there's a couple of zones stitched together.
Mm-hmm.
There, yes, but if that's the definition, then Witcher 3 is an open world.
In the case of Pokemon, I think Arceus exudes open world elements, but I don't know if I'd call that an open world game.
Yeah, I think there's different brands of open worlds.
Is Mario Odyssey an open world?
Absolutely not.
No.
Despite the fact that, like, each world is completely open for you to
Is Super Mario 64 an open world game?
It's open zone.
I mean, like, that's what, like, this is like a very semantic argument, but like, yeah, I look at Odyssey and like, it's vaguely level based. Like, I definitely, there is more of an argument for Odyssey being open world than 64. I'm trying to think, like, I mean, Galaxy absolutely isn't.
Right. I think the defining feature for open world needs to be that you give me an objective and I have the freedom to walk past it without doing it.
Mario Odyssey lets you do that.
No, I mean, but Mario Odyssey doesn't say you need to do this level. I can't in Mario Odyssey just go, I don't want to, and go to a different level, but unless I've already earned it. Whereas like in Skyrim, it would say you need to go to Whiterun, and I could go, I'm gonna walk past Whiterun and go to this other city.
Yeah, like the thing with Odyssey is you hit brick walls if you do not follow the story.
Okay.
It's maybe not very quickly. It requires a lot of like scouring the world around you. But like, I mean, there's even points like we're gonna talk about that later in the show. Spoilers. There are parts in the back half of that game where they straight up don't let you leave a kingdom until you complete a story objective.
Yeah, and in fairness, like Xenoblade 3 does have moments where it says, you know, we need you to do the primary thing before we're going to let you out of this area.
Yeah, like, and so far Xenoblade definitely 1 do that. Has done that to me too.
Yeah, in Xenoblade, it's hard to notice because they do a good job of placing the objectives along the route that you already intended to go.
Right.
Because Xenoblade is a very wide hallway.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to call it a hallway because that has a different connotation.
Right.
But it's not a square, if that makes sense. It is a rectangle.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a direction that's longer than the other direction, if that makes sense. But speaking of Xenoblade, because I know that nobody is tired of us talking about Xenoblade. sorry, it's going to keep happening.
The game's finally out. We can all play it if we find time, which I finally did last night.
Yeah, Neil's played a little bit of Xenoblade 3. So what are kind of your first impressions?
It's good. I just want to make fun of the fact that I think I played it for an hour. And by played it for an hour, I think I watched about 40 minutes of cutscenes.
Yeah, there's a long one really
it
early
is,
on.
It's like that and we were talking about it before the show, and that I think the story's good and compelling. They've given me too much of it. Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of flashbacks and a lot of like I want to say there's a segment where there's a flashback. It cuts back to where you previously could control the character for a battle tutorial and then cuts back to another flashback. Before then you get control of the character again. And like some of that stuff, like it's clear that like I like what the game is throwing down in terms of its story, but it is just like taking the longest path to get there, which I don't terribly mind. Like it's enjoyable. And once I did actually, I was about to make a comment to you, John, just about like how annoyed I was about it. And then I actually got to like control my party and move around the world. And I was like, oh, okay, no, this feels good.
Yeah,
like that loop of collecting doodads, fighting creatures, stumbling upon high level ones, looking for secrets. I do really like just the mechanic of it comes back to some of that gameplay and story stuff that we were talking about the other week, where how they do have that element of you being the off-seer and like playing off dead bodies with your flute. I really like that as kind of like a collectible, is looking for corpses
and
playing your flute to then like, you know, up your affinity with a colony that corpse is from. And like, because it's something that like, yes, I see a thing and I'm like, oh, I need to go over to this thing and play my flute. But it also does tie into how the world is and like the narrative that's going on, even if it is kind of just a silly like check the box, I'm doing a collectible thing.
It's a little awkwardly gamified.
Yeah,
but yeah, it does feed into the
and,
the
if, tone. And it fits it, like it fits in with the character of Noah so far. I haven't gotten. Yeah. I only have the one side Noah Uni and oh god, what's the dude's name?
Lance.
I haven't gotten the other three yet. I assume that's going to happen very soon. But I'm really enjoying it so far, and we'll see how it goes on. And I guess the last thing I want to call out, because I'm impressed about it, as something that not the only reason why I bounced off of Xenoblade 2, but definitely a pretty big factor. When we got to the bath scene early on in Xenoblade 3, I was like, oh, come on. And then the scene played out, and it's legitimately just like a pretty solid character development scene. Because it does have these characters that are in the middle of war, just have a moment where they're like relaxed and, you know, unsheathed, tastefully done. and then they just have like a conversation about like how the characters feel and how like how they have been in the past and how they feel now and how they are in the war right now. It's like a decent little bit of character development for a scene that I feel like if it was done in Xenoblade 2, I would have just been like shaking my head and being like, oh, Jesus Christ, Rex.
Yeah. Well, and you, I mean, it's important to note, you mostly see dude in that scene.
Yeah.
So it's not presented in the same way of like, ooh,
it's not a male gaze moment, which I feel like that's a lot of the stuff in Xenoblade 2 that, I mean, but the Atlas line, go back through the archives of connectivity to see more of the discussion on that, where it's not necessarily the existence of characters with boobs. Like, I am a fan of Tokyo Mirage Sessions, and I would argue that that's probably worse than Xenoblade 2 in a lot of ways. But it's just the way it landed with everything else in the game for Xenoblade 2 for me. But so far, so good with 3, and that, like, I think the characters are likable. I'm interested in where the plot's going. Yeah, music's great. I would like to play more of this video game. Although I do lament, I did not finish 3 Hopes before I kicked over to Xenoblade. But I did. I feel like I left off in 3 Hopes. I left off at the start of a chapter, and I think I should be able to go back into it. But it's definitely the kind of game that, like, honestly, if I were to never go back to 3 Hopes, I put like 30 hours in that game. I feel really good about my time.
Yeah, you got
what
you were looking for. Yeah,
but I might go back to it. But I just feel like, you know, keeping up with the Joneses with Xenoblade 3, because you know, in the hopes of joining you guys for the spoiler cast when I'm about 25 hours into it and you, Jordan, and Matt are completely done.
I haven't heard a peep out of Jordan, so maybe he's already done. I don't know.
He probably finished it in 22 hours.
I know that Matt's, I think, in the late 20 or maybe early 30 hour ish.
Yeah, I just basically point. I think all he did last weekend was play Xenoblade 3.
Yeah.
You can tell because he's, you know, just watch his Twitter feed.
Yeah,
I will see exactly where he's at.
Yeah, we'll have Matt on for the spoiler cast, but he's been keeping me up to date on where he's at and his thoughts, and we've been discussing it as he goes. He seems like he's enjoying it, so that's good.
I feel like I've been lied to before with Matt seeming like he enjoys something.
The nice thing is here, though, is that I'm here at the get-go, and I can talk him down whenever he finds something he didn't like. I can present the counter argument while it's still fresh and before he has like a firmly held opinion. So I think I can Sherpa him into liking it.
But then you didn't like the ending, so he'll get to the ending.
If
and he'll
Matt
be mad
likes
about
the
it,
ending, I'm gonna be crushed. I'm like,
he's gonna make a 40-minute video about how the ending is incredible.
Yep,
I can't wait.
I honestly would love to have somebody. I shouldn't talk about this too much, but I would love to have somebody explain to me why the ending is actually good, because I would like to love it. It sucks to, like, this game is incredible, except for that one part.
I'm really excited to get further in it. But when I'm honestly, a game that I've been thinking about a lot in the excitement to Xenoblade 3 is how freaking good the original Xenoblade is.
Yeah, which Alex is experiencing for the first time.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've going into this game knowing a good bit of some of the reveals that come later. So things that happen in the opening are like, okay, I know where this is leading. But I'm getting to the point now where, like, I'm past the prologue. I have Sharla. I did one of the first, I guess, dungeon-esque areas in the game. And there are some story beats that I haven't seen yet that hit really, really well so far. Like action scenes and tension and hype that exceeds anything I've seen in Marvel for the past like 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is weird because, like, this game came out in 2010. This is cutscene direction for a Wii game. And I think the action is hitting better.
I will tell you that as somebody who played this on Wii close to launch, the production value of the cutscenes was so insane to watch, given that the characters looked like they were quickly made out of like paper mache.
Oh yeah.
but then watching the animation and like the presentation, like, this is so good. The characters are ugly as shit, but it's so good.
Alex Calafi, in his review of the Wii version, which, keep in mind, this would have been 2 years after it came out because it was the North American version.
Right, the American Wii version.
So 2012. Because what it was 2010 in Japan, 2011 in Europe, and a lot of people imported, I know, and then 2012 in America.
That sounds right.
But I remember Calafi said they were like N64 textures, and people got so mad at him. But
he's
like,
not wrong.
But like, it was the kind of and I remember talking to him about it at the time that he's like, yeah, like the game rules, but like this looks like garbage.
On a macro level, it's beautiful, but on a micro level, it's ugly.
Yeah. And it's definitely like a see the forest for the trees kind of, or vice versa, or whatever. I don't know if I'm saying that right. It's late. But it's the thing where like, oh no, like the total package, like it works for the, you know, limitations of the Wii and everything, but call a spade, those textures are gross.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm happy to be playing the definitive edition. I really like, I prefer the art style post Xenoblade 2. I don't love that game, but I think that slight more cartoony, I guess, anime aesthetic works pretty nicely with this game.
Yeah, and I know John always reminds me of my initial feelings on playing Xenoblade Definitive Edition, which are that I was kind of disappointed because I thought it was going to look better than it did. But after spending more time and kind of recalibrating my expectations of a game when people are like, it's a remake. And like, yo, bro, that is a remaster. I get that there are elements of it that might be remake-y, but call it a remaster and then people won't be disappointed when it looks like an old game. But I do think like the definitive edition, I mean, call it the definitive edition for a reason. I know if Matt, I know you would probably disagree in calling it the definitive edition because they ruined the navigation, but I would call Xenoblade Chronicles on Switch the definitive edition of that game.
They got tell me where to go, which is nice.
They do, just not in the way that Matt likes.
I do. I honestly,
I do like the arrow from the original is neat. Yes, they broke the fact that you cannot have an objective marker on your map without having the dotted line leading you directly to it. Like the fact that those are not two separate toggles, as they are in Xenoblade 3, is hilarious. And silly, especially since I believe it wasn't like that at launch and they patched that in.
Yeah, like I agree with his complaint about that. But at the end of the day, like, yeah, I'm going to play that where it's just pointing me where to go. Like I'm realizing as I'm playing Xenoblade 3, which, as you pointed out, does have that like this is where you go if you want to progress, that it does not bother me in the slightest. I will ignore that thing until the day I die.
Half the time I have a really hard time seeing that line on the ground anyway.
I think it takes me a second. It's so subtle in a good way because
it's subtle. And it's also red against a generally green ground. And guess who's colorblind. So sometimes I really have to like sit there and go like, where the fuck did that line go?
Yeah, where is this wiggling slightly?
Yeah.
Is it not on the minimap at all? Because that's what I've just been using.
It's actually physically in the environment around you in 3.
Gotcha.
I do like how they're like, yo, this might map you through some tough enemies.
Right.
It's
not smart. It's just going to take you directly there. I mean, it works exactly like the follow ball in Xenoblade X. It's going to send you directly there in the shortest possible way.
But yeah, Xenoblade 1 is still, I'm very early in Xenoblade 3, but just, I mean, it's really the characters and the plot of Xenoblade 1 really hit home for me. That like, I think it's just a good group of characters. It's a good story. I like Shulk's arc throughout that game. I think that prologue sequence that ends, I mean, it's like an old spoiler, but I'll still, for the sake of this, I won't say it, but in how that the starting colony, how that opening sequence goes and then like basically pulls out and is just like, this really is going to be our Xenoblade Chronicles. Like that like opening 3 hours, I think I said it. There might be a tweet from me, although I think I might have deleted my tweets from 2012 when I played that game, that I was like, that was like the best 3 hour chunk of an introduction of an RPG I've ever played, because it just like gives you all the systems, introduces you to everything, and has a meaningful plot that then like just sets off the mission of the game in such a strong manner.
Oh, I agree. I think it builds very, very nicely in a way that doesn't feel either rushed or too slow.
Yeah, it's not too like cutscene heavy or anything.
Yeah, it doesn't like try and throw you way too far into the story or into the action. Like it allows the characters to have a little moment to breathe and introduce themselves. And then shit hits the fan and like a really bombastic way that gets you hooked right off the bat.
Yeah. And there's just, there's a lot of, and I think you kind of alluded to it, Alex, that like, yeah, there are some big beats that if you've just been, you know, a part of the Nintendo community and like paid attention to Smash Brothers games, there are aspects of Xenoblade 1 that have been spoiled over the years. It's almost unavoidable. But I still think there's a lot of like moment to moment beats that you come across, because it is a game that I could tell you what happens at the end, and I feel like that wouldn't totally spoil the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's enough twists that you can reveal several twists, and there are probably other twists that you don't know about yet.
Yeah,
right. And even then, like, you can spoil like plot beats, but you can't spoil storytelling. And so far, this game has done a really good job at storytelling.
Yeah,
when it comes to pacing, dialogue, characterization, just good moments. All of that has been working well. Like everything that where Shulk is kind of struggling with his premonitions and like not knowing how to use them, not knowing when to share them, and that causing some doubt in his mind, then Brian like giving him a pep talk, like all that's great stuff.
Yeah.
When it comes to the world, though, is where I'm kind of like, and all the side stuff, because I want to play this game properly. I don't want to just crit path it. I want to give it the respect it deserves. I don't want to just try and rush through it to get to the Xenoblade 3. I want to play it like the devs intended. And so I've been doing all these side quests. I spent like maybe an extra 1 or 2 hours in the opening colony trying to wipe out all the side quests. And I felt like all I was doing was busy work. And that didn't feel great. And now that I'm like past like Gower Plains, I walked around Gower Plains quite a bit, and I'm not sure if I gained anything from doing that. It almost seems like this game is bigger than it should.
Yes.
It's very impressive, but like it is kind of a linear game inside of a giant world.
This is Alex, this is fascinating to me, because this is something that like I talked about with people around when Definitive Edition came out, that like I think Xenoblade 1, for when it came out on the system that it came out for,
yeah,
know, as a Wii game in 2010, incredible. Like the scale, awesome. No,
agreed. Even at, like a new 3DS game, like it's yeah, super impressive what, yeah, they,
that's just
off.
Stupid.
Yeah, yeah. And like and as someone who played through that game and finished it for the first time on new 3DS, like it's functional. It's,
as Takahashi intended.
But playing that game on Switch when it's been a decade since it came out, a lot of games on better hardware have done similar things. I think the scale of it becomes less impressive, and I think that's something that you're probably reaching. And I think it might have come up and just like coming across some of our content that we've had for Xenoblade 3 go up. And like especially like the discussion around Matt's video about the art of storytelling on 1 and 2 is, I don't mind the busy work side quests of the first game, because it's a game that I'll you know, do the story and just be like, all right, like I'm gonna like listen to a podcast or just like zone out to the pretty music, right, and go do some stuff. But I totally understand that these side quests in that first game are largely just like, oh, like kill X of that enemy, find 5 flowers, it's stuff like that.
Yeah,
whereas that's the credit that I'll give to, and I think that immediately as I give a credit, I'm gonna take some away, because all the RNG blade quest crap sucks. But the quests themselves, if you get the right ones,
getting the blades sucks.
Yeah, those are very good. And I think that like the side quest content and how it, you know, deepens the lore of the world of Xenoblade 2, like that's great. And from what I've heard about Xenoblade 3, I haven't really encountered any meaningful side quests yet outside of busy work ones. I've heard that the side quests in 3 kind of continue that trend, but without the BS RNG stuff. And it is something that like I'm just happy to see that Monolith seem to acknowledge that, like, oh, like, yeah, the side quests of the first one might not have been the best. Let's try to improve that in the future. And X also has really good side quests.
X is
it's basically oops, all side quests in a way.
Yes. So it simultaneously has great side quests and also side quests that are exactly as bad as the first one.
Yep.
Yeah. And this is probably just me extrapolating from like current day Monolith and being like, Okay, yeah. So what they do is huge worlds that are incredibly fun to explore and look at. And Xenoblade 1 is great to look at, but like I feel no need to go and explore or, you know, go off the beaten path to see something super interesting or come across. Like Xenoblade 1 kind of plays almost like an offline MMO.
Yeah, every Xenoblade plays kind of like an offline MMO.
Right, and like at least the MMOs that I've played, there, you know, there's interesting side quest chains where things mm-hmm. happen. Maybe you learn a little bit about the lore in a specific region. Like none of that seems to be happening. It all seems to be just busy work, and I'm okay with busy work. I think it's totally fine for an RPG to have a decent amount of filler just so that you have something to do and a reason to, like, you know, go to one area and fight a specific kind of enemy and level up. But I want a little bit more. And outside of the main story, and the main story is fantastic, outside of the main story, I'm not seeing a whole lot that I want to keep on doing. So I might just end up crit pathing this game on like casual mode.
Honestly, that's good.
What I tend to find is a lot of times I'll pick up the side quests and then finish them on accident. Like that's something I appreciate about Xenoblade. Oftentimes does those get 10 of this item side quests and they're meaningless side quests, but you just pick them all up.
Right.
Get them all in your quest log. And then just as you're wandering around, it's going to occasionally pop up a thing and say, good job, you did it. And I'm like, all right, well done me. Like, I don't care why they needed 10 razzle basil fruits.
I want to see the numbers go great. Up.
Yeah, it's fine. I got the experience. And also, just as far as world exploration goes, I don't disagree that I think Xenoblade 1 especially, maybe it's a you know, limitation of the hardware, but like the world isn't as full of things as some of the later ones are. But it is just as big. It's actually, I think, bigger than 2. But I will say it does a good job of, if you do decide, all right, I'm going to go off this random path that has no story relevance that seems to go on forever, I'm going to go wander up the side of this cliff, you get experience points for discovering locations, which I love about Xenoblade.
I love that.
If you do wander up to this random hard to reach area, a lot of times those will be like secret areas, and then you'll just get a shit ton of experience points.
But can I go fishing in that secret area? Or can I do something else in that secret area?
No, that's it's the joy of exploration.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, is not going to appeal to everyone. And I agree that the side quests are a weakness of the first one. But I do still, for me, that made it like, if you give me an excuse to wander aimlessly around the world, I will take it. And for me, those just like, you found a spot, here's some experience points. That, like, I would rather do that to grind than fight enemies. So like that element of it really worked for me.
I don't know. It's kind of like finding a chest in a game, opening it, and the devs just say, like, good job. Here's some XP.
But sometimes that's cool.
Sometimes that's cool, but it is only that. It is like, it's just kind of like empty calories exploration.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm on a diet, man. Let me have my empty calories.
I think it depends on what, like, I don't disagree with anything you're saying.
Right.
To me, that has a lot of value. But I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah. And I'm not hating the game at all. I'm trying to make a mental adjustment as to how I'm approaching the game now.
By all means, like 100% throwing it on casual and mainlining it, like, fucking awesome. Like,
honestly, that's basically what I was doing on my replay of Definitive Edition when it came out. And probably after I finish 3 in 6 years, I'll probably go back to Xenoblade 1 and do a casual replay, especially after seeing a lot of our content about the lore and the storytelling, because I'm like, oh man, the ending of 1's so good.
I'm tempted to do a casual replay of Xenoblade 2 since I bought the casual DLC, because that was locked behind a paywall on 2 for some reason.
Yeah. But yeah,
I know it doesn't get rid of the field skill gates. So
yeah, if I were to replay that, I would just romp through it on casual.
Yep.
Because there's also there's some choke points later on in that game, I feel, or at least where it lags a lot.
And there are a couple difficulty spikes. Yep. Turn it on once, Alex. If you don't have it on casual mode by the time you get to Aerith C, just throw it on casual mode for Aerith C. It's long and it's got some difficulty spikes.
Yeah, I've been flipping it on and off, and like sometimes I'll keep it on casual mode for like way longer than I need to, just because it feels nice.
Yeah,
and it's, I've been enjoying it that way. It doesn't seem to make the combat that much less fun. It's just things go by faster.
Yes. Yeah.
That's fine. Yep. I don't want to keep dragging out the segment, but are you guys pro play as Shulk the entire time or switch around the party leader?
As somebody who isn't big into most JRPGs, I mostly played as Shulk, but I know that I believe that the popular consensus is that Shulk is not the best primary party member. And I know a lot of people actually lean into Melia, which really? I have never been able to get a hang of her.
But never really enjoyed playing as her, which is probably a little bit of why I didn't like Future Connected as much. But I am also like I like romping as Shulk, although it was the kind of thing where there's a couple bosses where I think I switched over to like controlling Sharla, I think.
There are times where like just like I can't
being
trust
able to control
you to
the
heal.
Healer. Yeah. It was a kind of thing of like kind of manipulating the team as a healer for certain bosses. I remember I haven't gotten to the back half of the game since the new 3DS. There's like a poison area, I think, that I think I use Sharla a lot for, just because of having that minute controlling over healing worked better for me.
That's something I've enjoyed in Xenoblade 3 is if I'm like, all right, you guys aren't doing your job, and just switch over to one of the healers and just run in and do what I need to do and then switch back to whoever I was playing as before is really nice.
That sounds great, because I have to do chain attacks if I want to do the whole break topple days thing. And it would just be really nice if I ever like I break as Shulk, if Ryan could just do the topple. It would be
you
so
kind
fantastic.
Of I've really learned to watch for him. What I can't think of what his topple move is called, but I've learned to listen for it. And so I'm aware if he hasn't done it for a long time, and I know it's safe to break.
Yeah.
Because he's on, you know, the same, you know, cooldowns
right.
that you are. So I kind of like keep an eye on. I'm like, okay, he hasn't done it for a while. He should have it charged up. I'm going to break now. And usually that works. And if I hear him do it, then I'm like, okay, no breaks for a while.
That's a good tip. Yeah, that's a good tip.
It's why they all scream out their moves.
Yeah.
It's not just for style points. It's a gameplay mechanic.
Yeah, it is hilarious.
Not a good
how
one,
chatty.
But it's there. Yeah.
I do something that I notice in three that I'm glad that the QTE stuff is gone.
I didn't even notice that was gone until somebody asked me about it. And I was like, oh, holy shit. Yeah. I don't have to push A while a circle goes towards another circle.
Yeah.
That's neat.
It happens every now and then. I'm not sure exactly what I'm doing when I press.
That's my
the
big
right
problem
time.
With it is that, and I think at one point I actually was like, what does this do? And I still kind of just forgot it.
In Xenoblade 1, it boosts your affinity gauge that you use for chain attacks and for reviving your party.
Doesn't matter like when I hit it exactly, or
you want to hit it while it's on the outer.
Yeah.
Ring okay. Is it are there two rings in Xenoblade 1?
I forget. I think there's two, and you want to kind of get it, you have to like get it beyond the first one, and you want to get it as close to the second one as possible, I think,
something like that. I don't remember exactly. As long as you hit it while it's within the thing, then you're golden.
Yeah, that's what thing. I've been doing. It's like, does it matter if I hit it just right, or
I don't think it's as picky in that one. I know in to segue into the Xenoblade game that I've been playing, because this is the Xenoblade podcast. In Xenoblade X, in that one, it does matter a whole lot where you press it, because in Xenoblade X, the entire combat mechanics and healing your party are based off of hitting those quick time events.
Yeah.
Because in Xenoblade X, there are no healers. And there are only a couple moves that can heal you directly in the entire game. Rather, the whole thing is based off of a character doing a move and then calling out the next kind of move they need, whether that's like a ranged attack or a melee attack or like an aura or whatever. And then if you do that, you'll get one of those prompts. And if you click it, then it heals the party. And so the entire game is about paying attention to what everybody's doing and doing the moves that you're requesting of each other, which sounds nuts. And is a little nuts, but it does work. And it's like weirdly kind of fast paced and more like exciting. And I kind of like it. But yeah, I hooked back up the Wii U. I have been replaying Xenoblade X. I'm four chapters in, and God, I love that game. It is something that struck me immediately is that while it's not doing as much fancy stuff as Xenoblade 2 and 3 are, it does render at a higher resolution. And I think overall, I think the graphics are kind of better. Like it just looks so nice. It's a little un-anti-A-list, so it's very sharp on the edges.
Doesn't the Wii U cap out at 720?
No, it can go up to 1080.
Okay.
But Xenoblade X is a hell of a Wii U game for like the fact that it's hitting 720 and like maintaining a more stable frame rate than like 2 had when 2 was running at like 360p is,
oh my gosh, 2 was a mess. Shit. I played that game on launch day. Oh Lord.
2 is it's one of those reviews that I look back on and I think, okay, if I were reviewing this now, not within the launch year of the Switch, where I'm like, I don't know what Switch games are supposed to look like handheld, I would not have let 2 get away with its handheld performance like I did. I think 2 is playable docked. I think it's really garbage. Rough handheld.
It is garbage handheld. And it really sticks out. I think Torna was better than handheld.
Torna was a little better. Yeah.
Okay.
I've heard that 2 was rushed. And that Torna, they were able to kind of clean up the thing. Because Torna does look kind of visually different. I think they were able to clean up a lot of the things they had issues with in 2.
Yeah. With playing Torna relatively recently and playing 3, it's like night and day.
Oh, and 3 actually looks pretty decent handheld.
Yeah, I have not played it on a TV yet.
Really? Okay.
Now I played Torna on the OLED too. I've been playing it on the OLED. It looks really good. It's definitely the environment. I can tell, and I think you called it out, that like the environments seem to be more aware that it's playable on a portable screen.
It pulls some things back. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is for the better.
Yeah. If you like in a dream scenario where you were playing these games on a system that could run them at 1080 or just at their target resolution at all, then 2 would definitely look better than 3. Like just in terms of what it's doing. But 3 winds up looking better on this device. It'll be interesting if we ever get a Switch Pro to kind of go back and recompare them and see if 2 winds up looking better. But X still looks just incredible. It's weird playing this now that because when X came out, like the only Xenoblade there was the first one. And so there wasn't a really strong sense of what the series was yet. Playing it now, having played 1, 2, and 3, going back to it is so weird because it's such a different kind of game. Like it almost doesn't quite feel like the same series, but my God, is it good. It has a really long intro. Like think Xenoblade's 3 intro is slow, Xenoblade X will sit there and slowly talk you through every single mechanic in a voiced cutscene. Like no tutorial prompts, just Elma or Lynn standing there talking you through every single mechanic.
With 3 is that I feel like they are personally responding to my complaints. But it is overly tutorialized and I'm like, well, thanks guys.
Yeah. It's tutorialized, but in a way that's very easy. Like with 3, there were a lot of things where I'm like, I know how to do this. I can kind of skip through this.
Yep.
So it works for me. Yeah, I won't linger too long on X. And I really doubt that I'll replay the entire game because last time I played through it, it took me over 100 hours. But I do really want this game on Switch. What's that?
Will you get to the Skell?
I don't know. That's 30 hours in. So maybe. I will say that playing it again, if they ever do port this to Switch, I will miss the gamepad integration because I forgot how nice it is to just like one of the early side quests you get is to go out and plant the whole game is all about exploring this planet and you have kind of this like hexagon grid across the entire planet and every few grids you need to plant probes that give you details on the surrounding grids and then each grid has like a thing you can do to complete that grid. And so one of the early quests you get is all about planting those probes, but then also changing what types of probes you have planted because if you chain together probes in neighboring grids, you get like bonus resources and stuff like that. It's way stupid complicated, and I love it. but just being able, like, when I got to that, I had already planted all the probes I needed to plant. And so they gave me that, and I was just able to look down at the gamepad, tap on those probes, and really quickly change what type they were without pausing the game, and then just go back and talk to that person again and was done with it. And that just, because this game is very, like, management heavy in a way that no other Xenoblade is, having that second screen that's a touchscreen to just do all that management stuff on is admittedly very handy. And that might require a little work to get in a comparable state on Switch, especially when you're playing docked. It wouldn't be too bad handheld because you'd, I assume, just bring that map up. But docked, that would be a thing you'd have to work on.
Yeah, it is. It is something like, I mean, there's a lot of systems in that game. That was one of the things that I think almost bugged me a little bit when I first played it. But it's, that is an aspect of games that I have only grown to appreciate more. Just like that kind of, I'm going to chill in this world and just mess with things.
Yeah.
So I'm actually for, did we, I think we mentioned it on the podcast, but we'll mention it again. Maybe we should, I mean, we mentioned it in the Discord, we should mention it in the article maybe. Wind Waker, we're playing it for 3D Zelda Game Club, probably end of August, I think is when we're eyeing.
Oh no, we're in August.
Yeah, maybe September.
Just start playing Wind Waker and let us know when you're done.
Yeah. Yeah, I have not, I guess I technically did start it, but what happened was I started a new file with my son, and he messed around with it and then managed to back out of the game and go back into it and play a late game save that I had from previously. So he's just been like in a fully decked out Link, just sailing around the seas. Also, gamepad integration in that game, great. And I like that game looks awesome, but I do have that means I have the Wii U hooked up. And this is my copy of Xenoblade Chronicles X is just staring at me, being like, for when you're done this, come to me.
My last note on Xenoblade X will be that with Miiverse shut down, roughly like half of the online integration doesn't work anymore. but weirdly, some of it still does. Like, you still join a squad. And you still see when people in your squad do things or get achievements, you get a little notification for them doing it, and people are still playing this game
because it's a good, like, video game.
I have a really full squad of people every time I play, no matter what time of day I play it on, and they are actively doing things, and it's bizarre. Like,
how does the squad thing work?
Boy, listen, I don't remember. When you start the game, you can join up with one of three squads based on how you want to play.
Okay, Pokemon
at this
Go,
point,
it
doesn't really matter because most of that stuff is down. But like, while you're playing, you always have squad goals that are like, you know, as a squad, defeat this many of this kind of monster. And it'll be some number that you're never going to do on your own. But across the 30 or so people in your squad, you could easily take out that many. It's not like direct multiplayer because you can't see them.
Right.
But, you know, you work on that stuff. So there are different squads that are like, some are more focused on you just want to play single player. You're not really going to worry about that stuff. Whereas others are like, you're going to worry about that stuff. So you join a squad that's specifically worried about doing those if you want to like grind out those points. The one, I don't think this part of the online is still up. And most people didn't know it was there because Nintendo never told anybody. But there was direct multiplayer in this game originally, where you could go into a room in your barracks that it never told you was there and pick up a quest like in a Monster Hunter style, where it would be like, you're going to go defeat this boss character. And then you would party up with other people online in a party of four, where the other party members were being directly controlled by other players, and like go hunt monsters. Nintendo never told anyone about this mode. What? I discovered it way late in the game, and most people I know who played this game had no idea it was ever there. And I don't think it's still active.
oh, no.
So tragic. If you do release this on Switch, Nintendo, you should tell someone that that's there, because it's a weird thing to leave out of your marketing of the game, that it is a direct multiplayer game if you go into the right room of your barracks.
Yeah, Pokemon doesn't tell us a whole lot, but at least they told us that there are raid battles you can do in multiplayer. Yes,
yeah, and this was essentially raid battles that were just in the game, unannounced. No one told anyone. But yeah, the other thing I've been playing that I'll just talk about real quick is Redout 2. I am working on a less of a review and more of a tech analysis, comparing it with the original Redout on Switch, but also Redout 2 on Xbox Series X, just looking at kind of where this one sits. And as someone who played the original Redout and thought it was conceptually interesting, but didn't think it played very well and thought the Switch port was a little rough, Redout 2 is really stinking good. It plays so much better than the first one. Like, the ships just handle so much better. The track designs are more interesting. Like, it's just more fun to play. It maintains a lot of the mechanics of the first one, where it's you know, kind of an F-Zero or a Wipeout style game, where it's very much about, like, you can both strafe left and right, but then you can also just turn normally. And it's all about how you combine those two actions. But then you also control, like, the pitch of your vehicle, like, up and down. So as you're, like, going up an incline, you need to pitch up. And as you're going down, you need to pitch down. Because, like, if you go down too fast without pitching down, you can actually leave the track and jump unintentionally, which can be disastrous at the wrong times. And yeah, it's just a really, really solid sci-fi racer that I was not expecting to be this good, given that I kind of bounced off the first one. I will say the Switch version is pretty low resolution. Gets dropped to 30 frames per second, which is not ideal in a game that's this fast, but it's playable. But it's still fun. I'm enjoying the Switch version a lot. I will say I've also been playing the Xbox Series X version, which runs at 60 frames per second and is a much smoother experience, though obviously you have to play it on the TV. But yeah, great game. I'll have a video out on it soon, but just wanted to mention it because I was surprised by how much better it was than the first one. So good job, 34 Big Things. Must be nice to be out from under Nicholas. That seems to help.
Congrats.
Yeah, well done.
Can we free Edmund McMillan from Nicholas?
Sacrifices must be made. I think we just need to shut down Nicholas, I think is what has to happen for everyone to be freed. And then THQ can finish buying. Because that's what happened with 34 Big Things, is Embracer Group just swooped in and we're like, we don't own you yet.
Yeah.
And they're all right.
I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, THQ, Embracer, also not great. Better than Nicholas? Yes.
Well, and it's the thing of like THQ has some issues, but THQ's issues are like we let the intern decide where we held our AMA. Like, all right, probably a bad idea. Like, don't do that again. Whereas Nicholas is like, we're not going to pay anybody. That cool? And it's like, oh no, that's super not cool. Like, please stop doing that. Like, so it's like, you can say like, oh, they're not great either, but we're not even in the same ballpark. THQ did a thing one time. Nicholas continues to be a problem every day of their lives. But yes, that's Redout 2. Alex, I think Matt and Joe went on vacation the other week. You've been helping out with some streaming. And so let's just give an excuse to talk about your experience streaming and maybe give a shout out to our Twitch channel, which everyone should watch if they haven't, or maybe if you didn't know we had a Twitch channel, because it's a good time.
Twitch.tv/Nintendo World Report.
It's the easiest link you could possibly think of.
Right.
Very self-explanatory.
It makes a whole lot of sense.
It really does.
Yeah, I have been streaming solo. As many of you probably already know, I do the Mario Party monthly streams with Matt, Xander, and Joe on
which
the first
are the
Friday.
Best.
Yeah, they're fantastic. It's a really good time, but it's a group stream. So like, yeah, I'm performing for an audience, but I'm not alone. So a lot of that burden is shouldered by all four of us. Solo streaming is a whole other beast, and it is both a lot more fun and way more difficult than I thought it would be. I've been playing through Fire Emblem, the Blazing Blade, though it was just called Fire Emblem when it was released, because it was the first Fire Emblem released in the West. And I'm having a great time. I really, really love that game. It's one of my favorite games of all time. And it's kind of cool just like showcasing that game to people who've never played it before, kind of going through all like the tips and tricks that I know, and having an audience there to like watch me fumble has been pretty fun. But it is difficult to like keep the energy up and like always have something to to say and not have any sort of dead zone at all. And like it affects, I feel like I lost like 15 points of IQ just by streaming because I can't think through my moves because I also have to think about, you know, do I sound okay? Are my audio levels okay?
Yeah.
Am I being entertaining enough? Am I responding to chat? And then also, like, I'm also playing a video game that, you know, has permadeath. I am playing an Iron Man run. So if somebody dies, they're gone for good and I can't reset, which is adds a whole lot of stakes and I think makes the stream more fun. But I make some stupid mistakes that I would never make if I wasn't solo streaming. And so I know that you've done a whole lot of streaming, John, and I wanted to ask you, like, what's your method? Like, what are your tips and tricks? Cause I'm still early in my solo streaming career.
You really have to just, I mean, it's hard to get, I guess another plug, we have started a secondary YouTube channel called NWR Plays, that's in its infancy. But if you want to head over there, it has stream archives of everything from when I was streaming on YouTube all the way up to modern Twitch stuff. But I glanced at a few of those as they got moved over to that channel. And I was watching some of my late era streaming stuff. And I was like, I could never do this now. Like, I felt like I kind of got the vibe for it later on that, like, I don't know if I still have. But a lot of it is just kind of like, you gotta let go and stop thinking about what you're saying, and you're gonna say really dumb stuff, but you just have to keep talking indefinitely. Right. I always found it easier, like, some of my favorite streams I ever did were streams where I was playing, like, Mario Kart 8 or Doom 2016 or some, like, online game where maybe people from the chat are playing with me, and there's constantly just things happening. There's no, like, single player adventure that I have to come up with interesting narration for this. It's just there's shit happening and I'm just talking.
Oh, narration's like the hardest part.
Narration's the hardest part. They weren't streams, but I let's played the entire Star Fox series. And some of those Star Fox Adventures episodes were hard to stay entertaining on. Just because, yeah, you got to keep up a constant stream of consciousness talk. And I think it is just practice. I would sometimes cheat if I was playing a single player game, and before I started I would have a guide open and I would look through what I thought I was going to be doing for that stream, so in my head I kind of already knew what I needed to do, which I found made it easier to then just talk.
Yeah,
but that only works in certain contexts.
That is the nice thing about Fire Emblem, is that, like, I've played this game enough to where I kind of know the beats of what I need to be doing. I don't need to, like, read a tutorial or anything. This isn't my first time playing. But because it's an RPG without any voice acting, I have to do all the voice work. And, like,
yes,
I don't do that. I wasn't prepared the first stream I did, and my throat was destroyed afterwards.
Yeah.
The next time I streamed, I was just guzzling water bottles left and right.
Well, it's especially bad. So I did, I did Star Fox Command. Mm-hmm. Like, I did that and, like, assigned voices to every character. And, like, I'd get done and, yeah, my voice would just be gone. And I'd be like, I'd start speaking as a character and be like, oh, this voice was a mistake that now I'm committed to for the rest of this. You picked a horrible game to start this with. Let's put it that way.
Yep. Yep. But I'm having a good time, and I think streaming and doing a challenge run is pretty fun. If you're interested in doing that, or if you're interested in watching me play Fire Emblem, that's gonna be Monday nights up until we finish it for Smasherpieces. That's the other thing. I'm playing it for Matt and Joe's podcast Smasherpieces, where they play a game for every character and Super Smash Brothers Ultimate. This one is for Roy from Fire Emblem, not Roy from the Koopa Kids. There are two Roys in Super Smash Brothers.
Yeah,
but yeah,
are they?
It's a good time.
Can we convince them that they need to do an episode for every single Koopa Kid?
Oh, you can try.
Are there?
Because, like,
are there even eight games with the Koopa Kids in them? Because what? There's three worlds.
Three.
I mean, post New Super Mario Brothers, maybe.
But does World have them? Aren't they dead in World?
No, World, canonically? You kill them. You kill them in World.
What?
Yeah, because in World, you find this deep Mario lore. for anyone who cares. In Mario 3, you fought the Koopa Kids on pirate, like flying airships. In Mario World, there is a sunken airship in the middle of the map that's full of ghosts. And the final area of it is a boss room from Mario 3. And there's just one of the spheres from Mario 3 that you pick up, but there's no boss in there because they're dead, because you already killed them in Mario 3. It's so weirdly dark, and like, it's one of the few instances of Mario being like, no, all of that was canon. That all happened. It's the best argument for no, Mario 3 was not a play. You killed those children.
That is weirdly dark.
I don't know if there's eight. I mean, there might be eight total releases that have the Koopa Kids in them, including the Game Boy Advance versions of 3 World, New Super Mario Brothers U.
We Deluxe, could bring in like the Super
New
Show.
Super Luigi. Yeah, make them watch the Super Show.
Yeah.
Are they in Hotel Mario?
I don't think so. Valid question, though. Speaking of Mario, though.
You know who should have been in Mario Odyssey? The Koopalings. Would have made the game better.
Well, I assume that the Ruined Dragon is just one of the Koopalings grown
so up. I played the back half of Super Mario Odyssey. The first time since I first played it that I played the back half of that game. Let me tell you, you know what is stinking excellent? Like the finale of Super Mario Odyssey. Holy crap. Just like what a video game. Makes me like I am knocking at the doors of Nintendo being like, when are you going to let these people make a brand new game? Because I'm also in the back of my mind playing Odyssey. I'm also like, some of these people made Bowser's Fury and that was also incredible. What will they do next? I would like to play that video game. But what stood out to me with Odyssey, and it's something that stood out to me in kind of every time I've touched the game since 2020, which is when I, due to COVID and also Nintendo's release schedule, replayed a lot of 3D Mario games and came to the conclusion that I think Odyssey is the best one. Although I would say that every 3D Mario game is generally both excellent and flawed, but the movement of Mario and Odyssey is still incredible. Just the ride that game takes you on as you go through the story is like thrilling and fun and silly and goofy. And stuff like, I don't know, the volleyball game in that one water area, like that sucks. Like there's a lot of moments like that where you just get to it and you're like, why do I get a moon by just like stomping on this coin frog for like 10 minutes? But then there's other parts of the game where you're like, that was really clever and unique. I like jumping through this area to like solve this platforming puzzle to get a moon. And oh, look, I go think like fourth dimensionally and go to the other side of this wall. And there's a secret moon there. Like the way that kind of all builds, like that's incredible. But there's just some of those moons. Oh, man, like some of the moons that you unlock in that game are just bad.
I would love Matt, once again, since you're listening, let me know if this already exists. I would love a mod of Mario Odyssey that takes out most of the moons and gets it so that like every map has like between 5 and 10 moons in it, and that's just it. But you need like most of them to progress to the next level. And like they're like the hardest moons in each level. Like that would be my ideal way to experience this game. I would love that.
So I do think that it's also, there's something in my initial playthrough. I guess I Berubied it, for lack of a better term. And that like as I was going through that game, I would try to do every single thing I could do in each world before moving on. That I've kind of learned through watching both my wife play through the game. I think she did that like in 2020. And then also like messing around with it with my son as he's been growing up. I think that is the wrong way to play Mario Odyssey. I think the right way to play Mario Odyssey is to just explore the worlds. When the game is like, oh, go to the next kingdom, just go to the next kingdom, ride through that story. If when you reach that, you know, excellent finale, if you want to go back and you want to explore areas and get more moons, sure. Like, and then do that. And when you get to some of those nonsense ones, or at least the ones that are nonsense in your eyes, don't bother doing them. Just go through it. All you have is just like some boss rushes and crap to unlock. They're not really good. Just explore the world.
Terrible.
It's weird because I think like the Mushroom Kingdom level that you unlock in the, like, that's awesome. That's really cool.
It's neat, but like it's mostly neat to just kind of look at. There isn't a whole lot exciting. Like, you don't unlock any of the levels for Mario 64.
That is true.
You just unlock the hub.
Which, yeah.
Neat.
It is very neat. I like the
the story that it kind of takes you on of like Peach, like just getting fed up with Mario and Bowser and just going on a bunch of trips. Like that little post game, like that part of the post game is great. Those bits are cool. It's the march to 100% completion that I think it's one of the weaker marches to 100% completion in a Mario game, which I think is a little bit due to just the scale of it compared to some of the other marches to 100% completion.
Yeah, and I think the problem I run into is that I get into a level and I don't feel like I don't feel like I'm like working towards anything. I just sort of hang out in a level until it tells me to move on. And I get like, if that works for you and that's how you want to experience the game, great. I just like, I don't need to 100% it, but I want to feel like, okay, I have to do this challenging thing before you're like, I need that payoff of being able to move on to the next level. Not just like, well, I got these 10 moons that I got on accident while trying to get to this other one. I guess that's all I needed to do. But yeah, I should replay it. It's a good game. I can't argue with it being like, I can't say it's a bad game or anything. I just it doesn't quite land with what I want. Bowser's Fury hit on what I wanted from Mario a lot more than Mario Odyssey did. But I will not argue that the ending is incredible.
I feel like it's, I mean, I think that, and I think it's one that I believe in the accepted canon of kingdoms that are good. I actually really like the Samurai Bowser Kingdom a lot.
That one's
awesome. I think the beef that people have with that one is that it is kind of like a straight path.
No, that's what it's I love as, about it.
One that, you know what that does? It gives you a goal.
Yeah, and I think the way that one,
nice.
the way that one builds just rules. And the real life dragon thing is still like, why? Why is one this? Of, what the one, hell happened?
One of my that might be my favorite part of the game. It's not because it's particularly good, just because like that went through a development process.
Yeah,
like somebody pitched that, artists worked on it,
and it's a good looking dragon.
And it's like from a different game. Like I don't know if you remember this, Neil, but around when that game came out, I had like a partial script on deciphering the lore of that kingdom and why it was there.
But it's also like you don't do anything with it. You show up to this area, you fight the dragon. There's literally nothing else to do.
And then you leave, and it's
and you go back to it. There's the dragon's just there, being like, "I'm so tired."
I think you get like two moons in there. Like, there's one other hidden thing you can do there, but I'm fascinated by that world, and I desperately want to know what the development process was. Sure.
Like, I have questions. I have questions that did not get answered. And then, like, you go to Luncheon Kingdom, which I think Luncheon Kingdom.
Right, you go straight from Dark Souls to just like, here's cookies.
Yeah, like, look at this. It's a little lava guy, and he hits a tomato, and it's lava.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that game's just a ton of fun. Yeah, some of the kingdoms aren't great, but the ones that are good are incredible.
Yeah, and I mean, that's true of Mario 64 too. Yeah, so it's not like that's a
I mean it's the kind of thing where I just it furthers my belief that I think Mario Odyssey is like the perfect 3D Mario game, you know, warts and all. And I guess, I don't know, in my mind I still view like 3D World Bowser's Fury as kind of its own like hybrid 2D 3D thing, even if Bowser's Fury is way more of a 3D Mario game than 3D World was. I mean, Bowser's Fury, if we're being honest, like, that is like, if they were to just make another game that's a bigger version of that, I'm so on board.
Make me a 25-hour long version of Bowser's Fury.
I think I have, through just like noodling around and replaying Bowser's Fury, I've probably put 25 hours into just that game.
Oh yeah.
And that's, some of it is because my child erased my save file and would be like, "Daddy, let's play Kitty Bowser." And I'm like, "All right, let's play through the beginning of this. Still awesome." But yeah, I mean, it's really this. I miss 3D Mario. It has been a year and a half since we saw a little taste. It's been almost 5 years since Odyssey came out.
We are hitting that point though where we are getting sequels to the Switch launch year games. Yeah. We're in that where it feels like any second now.
Earthwell 2, Xenoblade 3.
Yeah, I don't want to get 2. I don't want to get like super hyped for it, but like could 2023 be another year where we get like Breath of the Wild in the spring and then we get a new 3D Mario in the fall? How cool would that be? I would like that, please.
I know that there was like rumors of a 3D Donkey Kong game being made by that team, and I would love to see whatever that was.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is. I will plead the fifth to certain things, but just to plainly state what I believe the rumors are is, I think it was actually, I believe, some rumors on Odyssey 2 came out from, there was some kind of like focus test quiz thing of like, if we were to describe a video game like this, what would you think? And there were two games on it. One was what we now know to be Sonic Frontiers, and the other one was describing a new Odyssey game. And the fact that I think Sonic Frontiers turned out to be true, there's a good chance that maybe the description of the Odyssey 2 game that was there was true. I mean, I assume that there is a 3D Mario game being worked on in some capacity.
Yeah.
I also know that there is that rumor of the EPD Tokyo, which has been the making 3D Mario games for quite a while now, of them working on a new Donkey Kong game. Although I don't know, was it clarified that it was 3D? I always just thought it was like loosely a new Donkey Kong game.
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure. I guess maybe I assumed it was 3D because it was the 3D Mario team.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's probably not inaccurate. I just don't remember if it was specified or not.
Right.
I'd like it. We've only tried that once.
Yeah.
And honestly, Donkey Kong 64, good ideas, terrible execution.
Yep.
Decent multiplayer.
Yeah. Hilariously.
It's really fun multiplayer. I had a great time with that.
Let me say, this might be, I don't know if this is a controversial take or not. Most of my problems with Donkey Kong 64 are the same problems I have with Mario Odyssey.
I think that one of those games is clearly better than the other, and it's the one where you can
obviously
have a
Donkey Kong 64, that, but like that goes
monkey
without
that fire, yeah, has a gun that fires and spurts.
Right.
But no, I actually totally understand what you mean by that.
Yeah.
It's almost like there's too many things to collect.
Yep.
And it lacks
too
focus
much
because of it.
Yep. Yep. Now, granted, at least Mario Odyssey doesn't make you switch between like six different versions of Mario, and only one version of Mario can get each individual item.
Yeah.
That would be stupid.
And
no game should ever
turn Mario into Diddy Kong.
Yeah. Your knock on Odyssey, though, I think that does have, I mean, in that comparison to Donkey Kong 64, the difference is at the end of the day, Donkey Kong 64 basically slaps you on the wrist when you do something that you're not supposed to. Whereas Odyssey's like, I don't know, man, just roll around in a ball, we'll have fun, go dress up like a football player.
Yep. Mario Odyssey benefits from a modern, that's a more recent perspective on game design, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's that idea of like, whatever you want to do, it's fine as long as you're having fun. Like that's,
yep.
I don't think that mindset really existed when Donkey Kong 64 was being made.
Yeah.
Donkey Kong 64 is just about like, collect everything.
Yeah. Donkey Kong 64 actively hates you and your family. Yeah,
and also Funky Kong's a gun runner.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's simultaneously a terrible game, but also the best game.
Yeah,
and it really depends on how you.
And
look
I do
at it.
Like I
it
legitimately think Kong. Like it, the fundamentals of that game, not bad. It's just that
I think it
like,
handles well.
Yeah, it handles well. Like the 3D platforming's fine. And then like it's just like here, collect infinite bananas in the most obtuse way possible.
Yep.
Anyway, should we move on to the listener mail?
Yeah, speaking of new characters that were based on existing things, such as Funky Kong and Donkey Kong and the whole family. We got some listener mail. Let me bring that up so I can read it.
I have it up if you want me to read it.
You go ahead.
All right. Stephen B. says, hey, Connectivity. Since the release of Mario Strikers Battle League, I've noticed an increase in people saying the prior two Mario Strikers installments were the reason Nintendo supposedly forbade its development partners from inventing new characters for the Mario franchise. The thing is, I feel like we heard similar stories around the Paper Mario series the past few years. Meanwhile, Nintendo lets its mobile development partners invent illustrious new characters such as Dr. Goomba Tower. This has me wondering, is there any truth to these stories? Does Nintendo really prohibit developers from inventing new Mario characters? And if so, does this policy stem from unhappiness with Mario Strikers and or Paper Mario, or is Miyamoto simply grumpy? Kind regards, a copy-paste of generic Toad.
I don't remember, like, did Mario Strikers have weird new characters?
I think it's more like how they gave Daisy attitude.
Oh, okay.
Which I do think that element of it is a little overblown by the fact that I feel like Daisy kind of came into Battle League with a similar vibe. Maybe the crotch chop got taken out or something. I haven't looked at it, you know, side by side.
We actually aren't going far enough back. This is all a reaction to Waluigi's mere existence. Like, that's
Camelot's fault.
So, yeah. So if like kind of taking it from a very zoomed out lens, in that if you look at where all right, this is what I'm going to go with. You look at Nintendo as a company as kind of like Miyamoto being a weird toy maker, in an extent. Like, that's kind of how Nintendo was in the 80s, how they were in the 90s, was we are this creative force, we're making fun. And then something happened in the 2000s where they kind of transitioned a little bit. It was, I mean, Hiroshi Yamashi, he retired, handed the reins to Satoru Iwata, who, as we knew through the rest of his life, RIP. When he ran Nintendo, he did do it from the eyes of a creative lens. But I think the part that might have had more impact on this specific thing, although Miyamoto being grumpy could be a part of it, is I think what happened with Nintendo of America in the mid-2000s. You can see some amount of detail of that in Reggie Fils-Aimé's book that he came out, his memoir. Because if we're being totally honest, and I think it's maybe Reggie's fault to an extent, that Nintendo does have this edict of keeping the characters more within a house style. And I don't mean it as in like this was Reggie's decision, but I think that Reggie's emblematic of a modernization and update to how Nintendo as a company was being run, specifically Nintendo of America, where they went from being this like mom and pop shop, so to speak, to having eyes towards being a very definitive global brand. There's you can see in how Nintendo operates and how they pitch their developers through whatever major media outlets, whenever like there is like the interview with Time with Miyamoto as once again the weird toy maker or whatever. It's they're trying to make it seem like Disney. It's a concerted effort, and in order to make a thing be like Disney, you need to have more buttoned up rules about how those characters can be portrayed. I think you might be able to make ties to a lot of this, you know, late aughts is when, we do kind of have these moments where I don't know if Mario Strikers was necessarily an impact on it, but Paper Mario, like there is a direct quote of since Paper Mario Sticker Star, it's no longer possible to modify Mario characters or to create original characters that touch on the Mario universe. That is a quote from Paper Mario producer Kensuke Tanabe in an interview with VGC. Back around the launch of The Origami King. We know that by the late aughts, Nintendo did have those kind of edicts in place of this is how we're going to handle our brand and our company going forward. And I think it does come from that modernization of the company, of that desire to try to be what Disney has become. And we've only seen that movement forward with their expansion into mobile games, their expansion into theme parks. There's a lot more Nintendo licensing going on that I'm sure is depleting just a Berube's wallet as we speak. But that's kind of how it all is. Do you guys kind of see that as a possibility?
Yeah, I think that you're correct. And for some context on the Disney stuff, I don't remember if this was in, I don't know where I heard
was
this.
Was there like an Eisner biography or something? Because I feel like he would have been the start of that movement. Probably. And then my Disney specifics, I'm not as up on it. I haven't watched Defunct Land in a while.
I just know that, for example, when they were developing Epic Mickey, that they had to write code to always have Mickey's ears facing the right direction.
Yeah.
Like that's the level of like Disney has rules about like when you draw Mickey Mouse, his two ears, whether you're looking at it from the front or from the side, you can always see both ears and they're always both facing the camera. So like you'll notice if you play Epic Mickey and you spin the camera around Mickey's head, his ears don't stay in one place. They are always perfectly positioned for whatever angle you're looking at him from. Just to give you some context on like what, when we say the Disneyfication of Nintendo's characters, as far as how they control them, that's kind of where that goes.
And I kind of think that probably not until that like early 2000s. I mean, you can probably trace it back to Reggie and Iwata coming to power, whether or not I do think Reggie had an impact on it. I don't know how much Iwata might have directly had an impact on it. But they probably then had brand guidelines put into place. And when people wanted to, as I did hear in the clip from Radio for Nintendo, James Jones put it as putting tits on a Goomba, then that's going to go up to like standards and practices or whatever, being like, that's not in the style guide. We can't do that.
And that's, you know, different from, so Dr. Goomba Tower.
That's just three Goombas on top of each other.
Right. It's they haven't modified a character. They've just, and much like Mario Golf, Super Rush did the same thing where there are Koopas in that are wearing cloaks. Like, you can do that, but none of those Koopas are missing an arm or have a peg leg. I don't know why all of my examples involve missing appendages.
Well, I mean, like, you even look at, what is it, Admiral Bobbery or whatever, where it's like the Ba-bomb that like has like a mustache or whatever. I forget exactly.
Yeah.
And then you contrast that to the character who I believe is just there. Is he Bobby? Is that the name of the character in Origami King?
Origami Bobby King. The Ba-bomb. Yeah. And he's just a normal ass Ba-bomb.
And he just looks like a Ba-bomb. Like that's it. And I think that he's one of the best written characters in any Nintendo game.
This doesn't stop them from making new characters. They just can't modify exit. Like, the ruined dragon exists in Super Mario Odyssey. They can make new characters. They just
Mario modify. Odyssey is a pretty good example of that, because I guess you do have things like the Hammer Bros with the weird mohawk stuff. I also think there's maybe a different set of rules applied to mainline Mario games.
I have noticed that, yeah.
We're probably like
I think there might be some quote about saying that like it's mainline Mario games kind of set the standard, but I can't remember exactly where
that's
from.
Could they do a New Donk City in a Paper Mario game?
Well, here's the thing. I think they could, because they're not modifying.
It exists.
Even if it didn't, real humans are not a thing that were in Mario, so you can add those. That's fine. It's modifying an existing character is where the problem is. So you can, much like Origami King, like the Origami characters are new characters as opposed to changing an existing character.
I mean, you even look at like there's other characters in Paper Mario the Origami King where it's like an archaeologist Toad wearing like a different hat, but otherwise looks exactly like a Toad, just wearing.
He's just in a different outfit.
Yeah.
He isn't physically a unique Toad that you could identify. So I guess the separation would be, if the Toad was nude, would you be able to tell which Toad it was? Like, and that's where the line is, right? Because if it's the bomb from Thousand Year Door, like that bomb, because of like his mustache and all, like, he doesn't have to wear clothes to be recognizable as that bomb. He is physically that Ba-bomb. Whereas a Koopa with a cloak, if he's nude, you can't tell he was ever Koopa with a cloak.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. I think that's kind of where the line is as far
as... Naked Captain Toad looks like every other Toad.
He does. Yeah, I think that's where kind of that line is drawn. And I don't really particularly like Paper Mario, but I will sympathize with the people who bemoan this because I like the Mario sports RPGs and they also suffered from this same thing. And yeah, I do think it, you know, it's a bummer because I think it eliminates some of the unique charm.
I mean, we could turn this into a deeper discussion about how I think that modern Nintendo is on a path towards homogeny, and slowly we're going to, like, just talking about Mario Odyssey, part of the thing that I like about the game is it's so weird.
Yeah.
And I worry as we go forward, as Nintendo kind of does march into becoming this, you know, sleeker, modern, successful company, that we're going to lose some of that like, delightfulness of just like playing with goofy stuff and the weirdness. Even look at the transition from Mario Maker 1 to 2. That's something that, like, Mario Maker 2, while I don't think is bad, it is just more of a transactional, here is this robot game that we made because the robot that does finances said we should make this robot game. Whereas Super Mario Maker 1 is like, look at this font of creativity that is just like gushing with quirkiness and weirdness and character and personality.
Though Mario Maker 2 does give you nude Koopa in a car.
No, like, that is cool. Also, isn't that something from a game that exists already?
No, I think that was exclusive. I think, because I remember us reacting to it and being very excited, and I'm pretty sure it was from Mario Maker 3D
2. World. Well, yeah, because it's in the 3D World thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's not in 3D World itself.
Okay.
That's, yeah. No, nude car driving Angry Koopa is exclusive to Mario Maker 2.
Don't get me wrong, I love that. I also thought, like, skinny Mario was, like, performance art.
I'm going to be honest, I think getting rid of skinny Mario was probably one of the greatest things Nintendo ever did for the safety of mankind. and I hope that Hellbeast stays locked within his prison for all eternity.
Is there skinny Mario creepypasta? I'm sure there is.
Yes, I haven't looked.
If
but
not,
yeah, 100%,
we got some work to do, fellas.
I guarantee you, like, that is one of the most disturbing pieces of pixel art I've ever seen in my life. I don't know why it's so unsettling, but I hate it.
Is it really skinny? It's just human proportioned Mario.
It's human, but, like, yes, but then he kind of walks like a, I don't know, he has a weird creeper walk and a giant head. And yeah, there's just so much imbued into that 8-bit art that I didn't know
I love it
was possible.
It rules.
It's the final form of Mario, because you got small Mario, then Super Mario, and then skinny Mario.
Like, Super Mario was like, we're using technology to, like, make ourselves a hero that can protect us, the hero we need. Skinny Mario was like, we've taken science too far. Like, we only asked if we could, never if we should. Like, what have we done? Like, we thought we could play God, but now God is punishing us for our hubris.
I just looked it up. I think the item is called Weird Mushroom, and I love that.
Yep.
Yeah.
It rules.
It's terrifying. I honestly, if that game came out when I was a kid, Skinny Mario would have legitimately terrified me and given me nightmares. Like, I can guarantee you I would have had nightmares about Skinny Mario as a child. Because that is exactly the kind of thing from video games that would have just haunted my dreams. Yeah. So in conclusion, it's Waluigi's fault.
Yeah.
It's Waluigi time.
Is Waluigi not just tall, skinny Mario?
Ooh.
Yep.
Good point.
Oh,
see,
no.
Never thought of it that way.
Oh, no.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, you know what game rules? Paper Mario the Origami King. And you know what? It doesn't really suffer because of this edict.
Well, the one thing I wanted to add is that the thing that this edict doesn't prevent is, like, there are characters in Thousand Year Door, they're like the dogs that look like Brian from Family Guy. You can make those guys. Like, you can make
the origami characters and the weird stationary bosses.
Right. You can make new characters. Well, and even those, like, they look very different. You could theoretically make a character like the Brian dogs in Thousand Year Door that fit stylistically within Mario. but are not a Mario character, and that would be okay.
Wait, like, those are supposed to be dogs?
I assume so. They you know what I'm
like
talking about,
bad
right?
Bad Yoshis, like just like wrong Yoshis to me.
They look exactly like Brian from Family Guy.
Okay.
That's how I see them. I can't unsee it.
Wait, what? Somebody send me a picture of this.
Hang on. I'll bet if I search Brian Dog Paper Mario.
I sent it in the Slack chat.
Oh, did you already find it?
Oh, yeah, those guys.
They look like Brian.
It does look like Brian from Family Guy.
But yeah, so that like that guy, like he'd be fine. That I guess is kind of my counter argument to like this, like Nintendo maybe getting stale businessy, like that could totally happen. But in response to this being the reason, I'm like, no, you still have complete, you can do anything you want creatively. You just can't modify an existing character. Like,
yeah,
but you can make new characters. I mean, a lot of that is just the
Disney thing. And I guess you can make an argument that Disney's creatively bankrupt. But I think there are things within Disney that there are good things coming out of it, enjoyable content.
One could make the argument that it actually forces you, like, for as much as it may force you into just using generic characters, it in equal measure can force you into making entirely new characters.
Yeah.
Like, it can actually force you into creativity.
Once again, like, in Origami King, I think, like, the stationary bosses are soundly hysterical. I think the story at the core of it between the origami characters is pretty good. Like that's such a damn good game. Origami King for president.
Well, all right. With that, I think we'll call it an episode. Thank you very much for listening. If you're listening to this somewhere where you can review podcasts, that would be a nice thing that you could do for us. Presumably a good review, but you know, it's up to you. If you have any listener mail for us, you can send it to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. You can also hit us up on Twitter @connectivitynwr. And I think that's all the things. Make sure to watch our Twitch channel, twitch.tv/nintendoworldreport. Yep. And if you want to check out the VODs from that channel and from before we even had a Twitch channel, you can check out the NWR Plays channel on YouTube. Thanks for joining me, guys, and we will see all of you next time. Bye.
Well, bye.
This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details. I don't think they're in Mario Teaches Typing either.
It's like
Yoshi's Cookie?
Koopa Kid's appearances. No, not Koopa Kid. Damn it.
No, it's different.
This weirdo from Mario Party.
And don't you dare call him Bowser Jr. on accident. Or Baby Bowser.
Oh, the Koopalings. The Koopalings.
Koopalings, yes, right. Name. Koopa Kids are the
like weird default things from like Mario Party 5.
Right.
So 3 World, New Super Mario Brothers Wii, New Super Mario Brothers 2, New Super Mario Brothers U, Mario Maker 2. They've also Yoshi Safari. Yeah, we should make them play Yoshi Safari.
That'd be great. No
Hotel
emulation.
Mario. Mario and Luigi, they show up in most of those. Superstar Saga, Paper Jam, and Bowser's Inside Story plus Bowser's Junior's Journey.
Was that 8? set. I don't know how many you just listed off.
Well, okay. So, I think we're at 8. So if we were to build a Koopaling masterpieces, but we got 3, we got World, we got New Wii, New 2, New U, Mario Maker 2, Yoshi Safari, then we just need one more. You know what? Puzzle and Dragons Super Mario Brothers Edition. There's your 8. I got a whole masterpieces planned out for y'all.
Matt, I know you listen to these, so like you can't know it, not even plausible deniability.
Aren't there like alternate characters for Steve from Minecraft too? So like you have to play 4 different Minecraft
games. Well, you got
games
Minecraft
now.
Dungeons. You got the new Minecraft game coming out next year.
Legends,
or whatever.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do the Koopa kids all have unique numbers? Like, are they all numbered or do they treat them as skins? Because I feel like they're numbered, but maybe they're not.
Surely
Matt and Joe have already had this discussion, and I assume it was heated. And that there was like screaming and crying involved.
Yeah, I don't know if they're numbered or not.
Anyway,
like the individual Koopalings, like, do they not have a numbered order in which they show up in the game?
Well, I just know like every Smash Bros. Character has a number.
Oh, that's what you mean. Okay,
and I feel like that should be what define, like, if that's what defines whether they're a
they are not numbered.
Damn it!
So out of while we're on the subject, the characters who aren't numbered. Female Pokemon trainer, Alf, male Wii Fit trainer, female Robin, all the Koopalings, female Corrin, Inkling Boy, the different Dragon Quest heroes, Femme Byleth, which Femme Byleth should be the true Byleth, and then the Minecraft ones, Alex Zombie and Enderman.
Okay.
What a game.
Well.
Anyway, that was pointless.